We are real pleased to have Ashley Judd on the line with us. She's known as one of Kentucky's most beloved daughters. She's an activist, the best-selling author of a lovely memoir called All That Is Bitter and Sweet. She's an animal lover, a Golden Globe-nominated actress, an environmentalist, a self-identified hillbilly, and proud of it, and just one of the sweetest, strongest people you can ever hope to know. We're especially indebted to her for being with us today because she has only had about an hour's sleep on account of taking care of a sick little dog, Walter, all night long. So we are real, real glad to have you on here. Thanks so much for joining us here on Hillbilly Solid, Ashley.
Well, it's my pleasure, Silas, and thank you so much for having me. I love keeping up with you on the show, and it's a distinguished honor to get to be on it.
Well, it's an honor for us, and we're going to talk a little bit about your piece that was in the Daily Beast. That was in response to speculations about what has come to be known as the puffy face moment.
Mm-hmm.
The essay is beautifully written, and it ignited a great conversation about misogyny and the way our society feels free to criticize women openly for their appearances. Mostly wondering, to begin with, why did you feel compelled to write a response to that sort of media frenzy that happened about your face? Why did you respond to it?
Well, I do think that the writing was a very deeply personal figuring out of the experiences that I had had over the course of that week in March. And as with my best writing, it was simply deposited into my brain. It wasn't something that I considered or determined would be an appropriate course of action. I have been abstinent from all media about myself for over 10 years, and there's kind of a long story about that, but the short of it is, when my husband and I were married in the Scottish Highlands, we had found a small ancient church in which we wanted to have the ceremony, and the newspapers, who are inappropriately interested in people's private affairs, literally said to us that they would prevent us from going into the church until we provided them with the photo opportunities that they were demanding. And as a consequence, we did not get married in a church. We got married on a private estate where we could control who came and who did not. And I just made a decision at that time that I would not financially, emotionally, mentally participate in any kind of tabloidism, and even the magazines I enjoyed reading from time to time, I started to notice were using paparazzi obtained photographs. And so slowly Vogue magazine was off my list, and then all of a sudden everything was off my list. And so I would not have known anything about this extraordinary debate about why my face was puffy when I had been sick with a sinus infection for 6 weeks and had taken two rounds of steroids, unless my husband had really encouraged me to know what was being said because he was aware of it through the Scottish papers, and the laws are a little different there, and he felt I had very legitimate grounds to, number one, have all the newspapers apologize because their libel and slander laws are stronger there. And number two, it was just so extraordinarily nasty. And so I did look at the material, and one night it clicked in my brain how there was this constant damned if I do and damned if I don't. You know, if I the conversation initially was about this one appearance I did on a show called Marilyn in Canada, where it was real early in the morning, and as I said, I'd been sick and my face was puffy. And on the one hand, some people were looking at that picture and said, oh, her face is puffy. She's clearly just had work done. She's like post-op or whatever, post-procedure. And then some people looked at it and said, well, it's puffy, but her skin is absolutely flawless. Hence, she clearly has had work. And then she looks so bad. What has she done? She has effed up her face. And all of a sudden I went, they're talking about the same picture of the same woman on the same day and making all these different judgments, good, bad, and I just caught that double bind, and the piece came to me, and I spent a lot of time under a redbud tree, as a body should, and I just sat down and typed it all out in like 22 or 25 minutes.
Wow.
That's... Forgot all about it, but did send it to some of my mentors, one of whom wrote back and said, Ashley, this has to be an op-ed piece. And so I asked my publicist what they thought about that. We actually called and emailed Maureen Dowd from the New York Times and didn't hear back. And so I just forgot all about it. And then a week later, my publicist said the Daily Beast very much wants to publish it. And I said, well, I have to sleep on it. Well, I have to look. And so, again, there were these delays. So that kind of continued to add to how tremendously unlikely it was that it created such a national wave of intense conversation, because I had never positioned it as a public piece. And then it came out on a Monday morning, I think it was the Monday after Easter, and by that afternoon it had gone viral.
Right. Yeah, it was widely, widely read. I think it's so interesting that you wrote it so quickly, because it is such a beautifully crafted piece of writing, and I agree. I think that's usually the best writing comes that way. I don't know how it happens or where it comes from, but I do think that it comes that way, and you certainly have that gift. I know most people know you as an actress, but you're such a fine writer, and so I hope people who haven't read this piece will check it out, and will also check out your book. Well, there's one line, there's several lines, but one in particular in the essay that really struck me, mostly because I have two daughters, and I worry about them, as a father should worry about young women in the world. And this line in particular, I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about. You wrote, "The assault on our body image, the hypersexualization of girls and women, and subsequent degradation of our sexuality as we walk through the decades, and the general incessant objectification is what this conversation, allegedly about my face, is really about."
Well, a lot of people were pretty astonished by the essay. They didn't necessarily know that part of my consciousness and that part of my way of choosing to be in the world and my beliefs. And I had to chuckle at that, because all you'd have to do is go back to my women's studies papers at UK from 1986 to 1990, and you would see that I have been thinking and talking this way my entire adult life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, it all just came to me, but it's how I literally, it's one of the many ways in which I see and experience the world. So if Dario and I go to the movies and there's trailers on, I can't help it. I just notice the very gendered nature of what the studios choose to cut together as their trailer to introduce their film to a public audience. And then commercials. I mean, I'm thinking about commercials for hamburgers and, you know, commercials for socks, all of which use the objectification of girls' and women's sexuality, and increasingly younger women, and the suggestion at times of those women outright being children still.
Yes.
And it absolutely appalls, infuriates, and disgusts me.
Right.
And I have chosen to put my energy into changing that in a lot of different ways. Much of the work is in the public sphere. It's internationally or at the United Nations, and a lot of folks aren't familiar with that part of my vocation, which is fine with me. The conversation just kind of outed me, if you will.
Right, right. Yeah, there are so many ways to fight injustice and things like this. You know, I mean, there's a restaurant chain, for instance, that I would die of hunger before I would eat there because of a recent commercial. You probably know the one I'm talking about, which is so disgusting, of this girl making out with a hamburger, basically, on the back of a car.
Absolutely.
It's disgusting, and especially as the father of two daughters, it's repulsive, but I think...
it's also set at a drive-in.
Yes, yes.
You know, and it taps into that wonderful collective Americana,
mm-hmm,
of teenagers going to the drive-in and making out.
Right, exactly.
You know, and it's in a car, and there, you know, it brings up the idea of what kids get up to in the back seat of a car. There are so many, when I stop and take the time, and I was so grateful to have that opportunity in graduate school in particular, surrounded by like-minded people who helped me analyze and daylight all of the very subtle messages that are layered into a single image like that. And there's actually another commercial. It was for Carl's Jr., I believe. And a lot of times, the way the editing will be done in these commercials is that it cuts away from the moment, the woman, just at her most vulnerable moment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That most vulnerable and high risk for exploitation moment, whether it's the angle at which she's positioned, she is from behind, she is putting her chin down and turning her face away. It's really awful. And there's a car commercial, and I don't want to get, you know, cast aspersions on Dodge if it's not Dodge, but I've only seen it once. And again, there's a lot of imagery and sublimination around one man with multiple girls and women. And mm-hmm. he's driving his new car, and there's three other women in the car. And they're all making googly eyes at him in his rear-view mirror because he's got this cool car. And his girlfriend is in the car and her baby sister. And it cuts at the end with he and the baby sister starting to exchange these highly sexualized glances.
Mm-hmm.
And then his girlfriend giving him a smack.
Right, right.
It's so beyond unacceptable that it makes my blood boil.
Yes.
And that is to sell a stinking car.
Right. Well, another thing you sort of tackle in the essay is this whole idea that I believe that the best way to fight back this sort of to these sort of things is through art. I mean, it's the only thing that I have to fight back through. But often artists are told to just shut up and act, or shut up and write, or shut up and sing. How do you respond to that?
Well, I'm not going to. I'm going to do what I do.
Right.
I'm going to do what I do. And what's interesting, Silas, is to the extent I'm aware of it, when the public agrees with my views, they go, absolutely fantastic, Ashley. You go, girl. When they don't agree with a particular view, shut up and act.
Exactly.
Who do you think you are?
Right.
Stick to what you know best.
Yes.
It's amazing. There's this trend going on right now that I've experienced, particularly at times on my Twitter feed, where if folks don't agree with something that another person believes, they absolutely insult their very personhood.
Right.
There's a rejection of the very soul and humanity of an individual with whom we disagree. And I just find that so bewildering.
Yes. I think the internet, even when our name is on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, there's still some kind of anonymity that exists, you know, that allows that rudeness that we probably wouldn't do to each other's face, don't you think?
And I hope I don't, you know, get out too much in the weeds and the mud with it, but that's one of the reasons why I will, on occasion, respond
right.
to people on Twitter who act ugly.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I'm a person, you're a person, would you really say that to my face? Would you make an effort, if I'm in security queue at the airport, to come up and say how much you hate me?
Right, exactly.
And I have also found that a lot of times when I do respond to people in a direct way, they will apologize.
Yes.
And I have gotten a lot of consolation and hope through that. And I started with the sexual comments. You know, when people would say something to me that was inappropriately sexual, insinuative, and I would write back and just say, that's really out of order. And they would go, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry.
Good for you.
You know, or I might look at their profile and say, okay, it says here that you're a dad of three girls. Do you talk about women that way in front of your daughters?
Right.
Is this what you're modeling?
Yeah. Well, I know that you felt that the piece you wrote really resulted in a really positive conversation, didn't it? Do you feel it did?
It was unbelievable, Silas. I've never been a part of anything like it, with the possible exception of when Double Jeopardy came out and earned over $20 million in its first weekend. And that was before the digital era and social media.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was, you know, that kind of whirlwind magnified to the nth degree. And it was incredibly positive. And I think that that, you know, what that is about is, as I posit in the essay, it's not really about me. We all go through this to a lesser or greater extent. It may look a little different for me. It may be amplified and exaggerated because I'm a public figure, but we all go through it. And Dario was very adamant with me when we were having the conversation over a period of days about the extent to which both men and boys experience it as well. And I was really, I mean, if the whole thing was like a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10, it was an incredibly wonderful experience. And yet if there was one particular thing that blew my mind and humbled and pleased me the most, it was the full participation of boys and men in the conversation, mm-hmm. and how much they validated and agreed with my statement that patriarchy is not boys and men. It is a system in which we all participate, oftentimes very unconsciously.
Very true. Very true. Well, what is life like these days? Are you having some time to rest when you're?
Well, what life is like right now is pre-Walter and post-Walter.
Right.
This little dog has just taken me complete love hostage.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about Walter's story? It's a beautiful story and terrible story.
On Sunday of last week, a friend showed me pictures of a rescue organization here locally in rural Middle Tennessee called Snooty Giggles. And they had been given a dog that a lady saw thrown out of a window of a moving car, and he still had his collar and his backyard stake on, and they couldn't even tell what kind of dog he was. He was in absolutely the most pitiful condition imaginable. I, in fact, don't really describe a lot of the abuse that we can tell he's been through, because I know for myself, having been through it, there is such a thing as vicarious trauma, mm-hmm. and I don't want to dwell. We need to accept the facts and know that there's been tragedy and do what we can to improve the laws in our area and prevent that from happening to another living creature. But I can't really stay in the tragedy of it. I need to, you know, make sure I'm in the solution and in the hope of Walter's story. But suffice to say, he was in real bad shape. And I sent the picture to Dario, and I said, they can't tell what kind of dog this is, but this is a cockapoo. I mean, he is an absolute doppelganger for R2, Buttermilk, and Shug. And we went to meet him. Oh, this was cute. Dario was away because he was racing in Brazil the day I saw the pictures. He takes the red eye. He comes home, and he walks in the house as he says, is Walter coming to live here? And I was like, I've married the right person.
Yes.
And we, after Dario's nap, went over to meet Walter, and it was just love. It was just absolute and total love, and we were lying there in the grass with him. And Channel 2 News showed up. They were doing a story on this animal abuse case, and we just happened to be there visiting. And the vet looked at me, and she was like, would you be one? And I said, of course I would. Silas, I had on my nightgown. I had done yoga, so I had my hair in pigtails. I was in my nightgown, and I ended up chatting about Walter, as did Sean Aswood, who's really the remarkable soul force behind Snooty Giggles. I mean, this is her whole life.
Right.
And I don't know, Walter just wiggled into my heart, and I suddenly had life post-Walter. He's been my absolute and total focus. Dario opened the fridge the other day, and he's like, where's all the food? And I said, well, I took it to Walter's. He gets in bed, he said, where's my pillow? And I took him to Walter.
Yes, I love getting the daily updates about Walter, and he's stolen my heart, too, and lots of people. So it's a... wonderful how you're taking care of him. I wish that I lived closer so I could be one of the people to go and do a shift with him, because he's
People can join Team Walter. There's a beautiful T-shirt that a local company made at their cost, and they're selling, and all the proceeds go to Snooty Giggles to help their work with other dogs like Walter. And I also remind people, you've got organizations like Snooty mm-hmm. Giggles right in your area, and you can support them, which is a very direct and real way of also helping Walter.
Yes. Well, thanks so much for all that you do. You do so much good work, and we appreciate you so much. And before we close, I wanted to ask you if there's a particular song or band or music that you've been really into lately, anybody that you're really loving.
have been hearing Patty Griffin's song, Mary, in my head a lot. And I think that when I spend all this time with Walter and do the night shifts and, you know, get 37 minutes of sleep like I did last night, I'm real clear that there is a limit to my own power, to my own empathy, to my own compassion. And what I have the opportunity to do is get myself out of the way and let a power greater than myself work through me. And I saw a beautiful painting at the Frist Museum here in Nashville about a year and a half ago of the Virgin Mary, and she was in that painting called Our Lady of Consolation, and she was presented in kind of the Grecian fashion, sitting very strongly on, you know, some kind of a, it wasn't necessarily a throne, maybe, I don't know, but she just obviously was very grounded and a very powerful presence, and there was a mama who had come to her with her dead baby, and she has laid her dead baby at the feet of the Holy Mother and draped herself across Mary's lap. And Mary has this look on her face where she gets it.
Right.
You know, she gets it. Her son died, and she was the one who took him down after he had been tortured. And yet she also knows about grace and redemption and forgiveness and eternity. And it's the most powerful mixture on her face of we are spiritual beings having a human experience, and it includes a lot of suffering, but there can be that consolation. And so Patty's song has been, I feel sometimes when I'm lying there with Walter, I feel like literally Mary has my back.
Yes.
I feel like she has my back, and it's just coming straight through my chest and straight through my heart for that little dog.
We actually played a Patty Griffin song earlier in the show, but I think we can do two of them and close the show out maybe with that. It's a really great song. She's one of my favorites. Well, thanks again. Maybe you can get some rest. Take a nap.
Well, Walter, by the grace of God, is having a good day. He had a very, very rough night. You know, I wouldn't have it any other way. I'm glad I could be the one that was there with him during a tough one, and I'm hoping that Dario and I can sleep there tonight and actually get some sleep and just set the alarm every hour to get up and check on
him.
And that's good enough.
Well, I'm sure that all the listeners out there are going to be sending Walter lots of love, so he'll get even more than he's been getting, a big wave of it. So you take care.
Well, speaking of love, Silas, I love you to pieces, and I appreciate you so much.
Oh, you too. Thanks a lot, Will. Talk to you soon.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.